You're in tune with What It Is on WNCW. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Fred Mills and Carol Rifkin. Lately, seeing releases from artists like Johnny Cash, Jack Rose, Ali Farkas Touré, and many others has led us to think about posthumous releases in general. And there's a saying that goes that the best thing that they did for their career was to die young. And there are many in that category today, although a few exceptions.
Well, cue up the Jim Carroll song, "These Are People Who Died." That's a good point. I mean, so many artists. In recent segment, we talked about Jimi Hendrix and the avalanche of posthumous releases. I'm sure that much more income has been generated since Hendrix died than in his time, just by sheer volume and the accumulation of time. But more importantly, the archival value of stuff in the vaults is become known to be a quantifiable thing, whereas in the past you might have somebody die and this, oh well, he was working on an album when he died, so we're going to put this out and that's it. But now you have people that apparently have, you know, hours and hours of reams of recordings. So what do? Well, you put them out in a systematic manner, and it is the right of the estate and the heirs. It, just like any other valuable piece of stuff that gets handed down, whether it be real estate or property or jewels or a bank account, these recordings in the vaults are what they should have the right to. I don't want to use the word exploit, but for lack of a better term, that's almost a legal term anyway. They should be, hopefully they can do it with sensitivity. But I remember talking to Erman Schmidt of Can. And he was talking about a series of reissues. And at that point, no one in Can had died. The guitarist has since died. But he said that he remembered talking to his family. He's got grandchildren and everything. He said, you know, and talking to the members of the band. He said, these recordings we have here, these are our life insurance policies that we pass down. And that's always stuck with me, because it's a great thing to be a purist and everything and not – and attach material value to stuff, but that's doesn't really have any application in the real world. So that's why you see this constant plumbing of the vaults, because it is a commercial thing.
There's a certain amount of it that's just respect for the artists too, though, I think, in a couple ways. One, I'm always happy when someone I really admired and liked, and you know, they were on LP 30 years ago. I love when those are released on CD posthumously. I just, you know, that's just such a chance to hear great music. And a lot of times, too, to hear one of my favorite artists. I'm a big schmuck for the greatest hits recordings. I love those, because if I liked the artist, it's like, wow, they took all my favorites and they put them in one place. So I like that, too. I don't always like the tribute CDs. I always wonder if I get a little cynical with the tribute CDs, because sometimes they're really great and people do a really great job of representing the music of that artist. And sometimes you think, gosh, I wonder if they were just trying to get on a record, you know, and here was their chance.
Well, add that to the list of types of posthumous releases, mm-hmm. because there's several variations. You got everything from live material, a la Jimi Hendrix, live at Fillmore East, right. For example. Yep. You've got mostly finished studio albums that needed just a little bit of touching up, or maybe a couple of parts for certain instruments, what have you. And then only sketches or partially completed works that were fleshed out more so after the passing of the artist. And so you get all sort of gradation in this conversation.
And gradations in quality, too. We've recently taped a segment on the latest Johnny Cash album, American Six, and those recordings are fairly stripped back and minimalist, but they are still fleshed out by contemporary backing music from the Heartbreakers and Avets and folks like
that.
They're
really high quality.
Exactly. Yeah. That's an example of something done with taste and sensitivity towards what the artist was all about. In other instances, you had that legendary example, speaking of Hendrix, where some of the albums that came out shortly after his death, War Heroes being one and Nine to the Universe being the other one, I believe, where the producer, Alan Douglas, took a lot of flack for tacking on then-contemporary backing music to some of Hendrix's ideas and sketches, as you call them. So, it, you know, that's the opposite poles, where you mentioned the fans, you know, how we as fans love to hear this stuff, the early stuff, the unreleased stuff. But what's sometimes lost in the shuffle is what was the artist's intention. And you do have some folks that'll say, oh, so-and-so never would have wanted this to come out. He would have been offended or embarrassed to have the public hearing this. But once it gets into the hands of other people, and me as a fan, you know, I want to hear it too. If I were curating some artist's musical estate, I might be going through stuff and say, wow, people have got to hear this. There might be a note there on the reel in the handwriting of the artist not to be shared, but I would still want people to hear it because that's the fan side of me.
I guess in the great democracy of music, you know, I guess the deal is if people will buy it, maybe we should do it. But it's not always good.
If you release it, they will come.
The Johnny Cash CD is really extremely well done, and a lot of them, most of them actually really are. But there are a few out there where I think they lose track of the artist and what the artist meant and what their sound was, and I'm not such a big fan of those.
Here are maybe a short list that I've cobbled together of albums that are really, really worthwhile that are posthumous releases. Say, for example, Janis Joplin's Pearl. Albums like Elliott Smith's From a Basement on the Hill also falls into that category of an album that had a direction change from what it probably would have been if Elliott Smith had lived, because of the producer involved and changing the sort of the tone of the overall record. Also, music from Joy Division, Closer, just an all-time classic record that was posthumous release. I think it must have been very much largely completed when Ian Curtis died. But I throw those up there. You got any, Fred?
Well, you mentioned Elliott Smith. There was another one that came out just a few years ago called New Moon, which was basically demos from 94 to 97 original recordings. And I thought that had the kind of the sound of a barrel being scraped a little bit. Elliott Smith had quite an enthusiastic fan base, and I'm sure that they enjoyed him. But the material itself just was substandard. Jeff Buckley, Songs to No One in 2002. Now, that's an example of, a couple of early posthumous Jeff Buckley titles that came out were very good. Sketches for My Sweetheart the Drunk was wonderful, but this one, Songs to No One, just, it sounded like there was a reason that was not released initially. Pretty much anything that came out after Johnny Thunders died was definitely barrel scraping. Because then that's another thing. Sometimes you have all these shady people coming out of the woodwork that they've got these tapes that they recorded, you know, say one drunken night in their living room.
Or pizza tapes.
Yeah. Or a bore tape from some sloppy live recording, but because this artist is gone, and he's bankable, and there's a certain core of fans. It might be 1,000, it might be 10,000, it might be 100,000 that will buy anything. So these entrepreneurs see an opportunity, and because of licensing gray areas, they can get away with it. Well, Michael Jackson, I won't even get into that. It's been a lot of Zappa titles to come out.
Now, you can't get beyond the number of releases that he had while he was alive, I'm sure, because that was 50 or more.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of artists that seem to have had more releases in the afterlife, a la Tupac and Hendrix.
Mm-hmm, Tupac, yeah. I'll give you an example of an artist that the quality is there of the performances and the presentation of the packages, of these posthumous packages, very good. Tim Buckley, speaking of the Buckley clan, there have been several wonderful live albums that came out. There was including one that came out last year called Live at the Folklore Center, that the recording is an intimate recording, some very nice liner notes and packaging for the booklet and everything, and it just seemed like that captured a special moment in the man's career. So that brings to mind the way it's presented, you know, as opposed to one of these Johnny Thunders albums that's just thrown out there on the marketplace on some fly-by-night label. When you have archivists like Legacy Recordings and Rhino Records doing it and doing it properly. There was a Graham Parsons box that came out a few years ago that was just perfect. You know, just, you know, A-plus presentation all the way down the line. So if it serves the artistic intent, that's one measure. If it serves the fans and collectors, that's another measure. And, you know, the wild card is does it further the legacy as opposed to it just being a collection of recordings that, you know, or half-baked demos and remakes and everything else?
Oh, yeah. And I guess it is about the quality in the end, just like anything else of the recording. I know in old-time music there aren't probably as many records, let alone compilations, coming out all the time, but a really spectacular one that came out last year was the Charlie Poole collection was done by Hank Spoznik from New York, who's actually a really famous classroom musician, but is a wonderful traditional fiddle player and old-time musician. That's just the perfect example of a well-thought-through, well-engineered, well-recorded, well, you know, everything about the Charlie Poole collection is really well done. And there have been other historical, I know in bluegrass, there's lots of bad covers of the Stanley Brothers, but one of the most tasteful compilations of their duets was by Ricky Skaggs and Tony Rice. Years and years ago on LP that has really stood the test of time, the Skaggs and Rice sing the Stanley Brothers. So if it's well done and well engineered and well played, I guess it's like everything else. If it's good, it's good.
I would add to that list the new Hank Williams box
set. Right. Yes.
All of the MSM recordings that had a time of legal wrangle before they were released legitimately. There were some bootlegs that got out before it became the official box set that it is now. Wonderful addition to his catalog. Also tangentially here would be the Woody Guthrie poems that have been put to music a la Mermaid Avenue and many other artists, taking the spirit of his lyrics and putting them to song and sort of recreating the magic.
Well, that model is, and that is presupposing that there's some built-in historical and archival value to these recordings, and sometimes it's the passage of time that dictates that. I don't think you can necessarily, now, Tupac fans, don't get in an uproar here, but I don't think you can necessarily say that because of the recency effect, all those Tupac recordings have the historical value that an old Hank Williams thing, and this isn't country versus hip-hop. This is something that the passage of time has made us clear that Williams had a lot of landmark recordings, same way with Woody Guthrie. I wonder, all the Hendrix recordings, are all those historically significant? Some may be, some may not be. And that's a tough thing to judge. It makes you wonder, where does the tipping point become when you are going through the archives and digging stuff?
Some artists don't have that much left over because they've released it all already.
Right, they do the records. I think most artists work that way. They plan a record and they pick the songs and they do those songs, and there's usually only one or two left over. You know, it's unusual, unless you own your own studio or you have access to it, it's unusual to have that much extra material.
Like, you don't see any Doors records coming out anymore.
Right.
That was pretty much it. What we've already heard is pretty much it.
Yep.
It's pretty cool, though. I interviewed Sarah Lee Guthrie last week, and talking about the Guthrie show at Diana Wortham Theater that Fred was talking about, how wonderful it was. And she has just put out a kids record called Wagaloo. And on it, she's written music with her kids to her grandfather's, Woody Guthrie's, lyrics. And I think that's like just such a great use of the material and such a great story.
Well, that would be the positive spin on the tribute notion then.
Absolutely. Lots of tributes are great. I'm whining.
Trying to tap into the original spirit and present that in a new and engaging way.
What do you think? Email us what it is at wncw.org. We're talking about posthumous releases for public radio. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Carol Rifkin and Fred Mills. Until next time.